This is part two of a podcast which is explaining the sun. In part one, we looked at the Earth orbiting the sun in an ellipse, and everything is going anti-clockwise when you're looking from the north down to the south. Looking down from the north to the south, you see the center of the galaxy. So this is just the way we're oriented at the moment, but the Earth orbiting the sun in an ellipse, roughly circular ellipse, forms a flywheel or a gyroscope. So this gyroscope maintains its orientation as we spin around the galaxy every 100 million years. And so in 50 million years, the center of the galaxy will be in the northern hemisphere. It's not anything unusual. It's just the gyroscopic effect maintaining the orientation of an axis. So you'll have gyroscopes in missiles, in planes, in all sorts of devices, which maintains its sense of angle as it moves around the place. So if you have a top, for instance, or I used to have a little gyroscopic toy, you can see that. The sort of second aspect from last time is that everything is rotating in an anti-clockwise direction. So the Earth rotates or orbits anti-clockwise around the sun, taking 365 and a little bit days. That's really roughly 1 degree a day going anti-clockwise. It itself rotates anti-clockwise, and that means that the Earth has to do a full rotation plus a degree each day. So the day as measured from space, if you're sitting above the Earth in space, would be only 23 hours and 56 minutes long. It takes an extra 4 minutes to rotate that next bit as it goes around. There's other things which are anti-clockwise, which we'll get into as we describe more about the sun. Last episode, I got up from the core, the radiation central zone, to the convection zone. I got into the photosphere and into the chromosphere, began to describe as you move out. So I'll describe some of that. And as these podcasts are just training podcasts for me to get more advanced in speaking with the ums and ahs and actually putting things together more coherently, I was just practicing, and luck would have it that my son came along and said, oh, I can't quite remember, I had to come in, feed someone dinner, drive them off somewhere, as you do if you're a dad. So I've got six kids up here in the Blue Mountains in Australia. But before much ado, I'll introduce the title of these podcast series. This is Peter Hill Explains, where I discuss things scientific. Going a little bit back, the overall theory is that by getting a practice podcasting and looking at the feedback from various people, I'll improve. And having done the podcasting, you listen to radio programs and you say, oh, look, that's beautiful the way that they've described things. So let's get back into the sun. So I've described just not previously, the last little introduction, I've covered what was done in part one. Now, we're going to get into more description of the sun. How much bigger is the sun than the Earth? Well, it fits 100 Earths across. The Earth is 100 times smaller than the sun. So if you have a meter ruler, you take 1 centimeter, a marble 1 centimeter, and a large inflatable beach ball, which is 1 meter across, that's the rough difference. Now, that size difference is something that you can imagine, you can actually see from space, from a long distance. You can actually see the Earth, the reflected light from the sun hitting the Earth and going into the various space probes which we've sent, have looked over their shoulder, looked back at the Earth and seen this little blue marble, as it's been called. The sun is big, but not incredibly big. But even at 100 times further across, a sphere 100 times across, that's got a volume of over a million times the volume of Earth. And having a density in the center, at least, much, much greater than Earth, it's got well over 99.8% of the solar system's mass is inside the sun. So really we're just little specks, a little bit of pollution, so to speak, rocky pollution, which remains from the gas cloud that formed our sun many, many years ago. I think we're a population one sun, so I'll just go into it. Our sun is made, it's a metal-rich sun, so there are suns which are just made from hydrogen gas, and they burn slightly differently. So ours is made 4.5 billion years ago. So, or 5 billion years ago, that's when the sun formed, the Earth formed 4.5 billion years ago. And a billion years is 1,000 million years ago. So just to put that in perspective, I think we're tracking the human, the modern humans up to 2 million years ago. The definitive time when I was growing up was 200,000 years that modern humans have been here. The dinosaurs were wiped out 64 million years ago, and the origin of multicellular or complex life is roughly 500 million years ago. So in terms of the age of the sun, it was produced 5 billion years ago, or 4.8 billion years ago, around that time zone. I should warn you that I'm doing this off the top of my head, and the aim of this podcast, my friends overseas, is to basically get into explaining things clearly with some pictures and stuff like that. So going back, we're discussing the size of the sun and the age of the sun, and saying the sun was formed, it's believed, when shockwaves of a supernova pushed the gas together of a gas region and in intergalactic space. So intergalactic space, as we'll find out later in this episode, is full of a very tenuous hydrogen gas, but we can be formed in a hydrogen gas cloud. And this is pushed together. Now, fortunately, our origin story gives us a date of birth, and we're made of the same material. So you can look around this region of the galaxy and look at the various stars. And if a star is as old as us, for its size, and it's got the same chemical elements in it, it's really like a DNA print. So we can see sister stars of ours and other things. We can see stars next to us and actually draw a family tree of the stars around us. So let's get back into it. We've got our sun is in the galaxy, and we're orbiting around the sun, and our orbit, our plane of orbit, is across the plane of the galaxy, and the axis of the orbit is pointing from the north down into the center part of the galaxy. And just to pull the description now, what I want to talk about is the actual components of the sun, and I want to give you sort of a roadmap of the various layers, talk a little bit rather quickly on the layers I've talked about before, but as you go across, you'll realize that there is an extraordinary thing happening in the sun. If you look up at the sun, it looks as though it's held in a bulb. It's got sort of a glassy, very precise finish to it. In fact, you can, when you see it, the sun, the shadows have a very sharp edge to it. So the sharp edge to the shadows is the fact that the sun itself is a sharp edge source, and in fact, if you do the physics and maths of it, it's got a uniform, because it's a sphere, it's got a uniform brightness, so it goes from inside the circle, it looks like a uniform disk of brightness, and this is just the physics of light emitting from a surface and emitting uniformly at all degrees. So when you do the maths of it, you get a uniform brightness. So it's actually a step function. It goes from no brightness pretty well up to a quick step function of uniform brightness all the way across. And so basically things at an angle, there's more of a, at the angle there's a greater distance than an angle, so the greater amount at a greater angle to us emits. You really basically have to do the maths for that one. Let's get back into the sun itself. The sun is made out of primordial, mostly hydrogen and helium left over from the Big Bang. So the Big Bang happened 13.8 billion years ago, and we know it so well because we can actually photograph the Big Bang. So we can actually see the Big Bang. So seeing the sun, we see the sun 8 minutes into the past. The moon is 1 second into the past. And the sun is 400 times length of time into the past, or it's 400 times further away than the moon. We covered that last episode. And this also means that the sun, taking the same angular position in the star, in the sky as the moon, means that the sun is 400 times bigger than the moon. So the moon is 400 times closer, but it's also 400 times smaller. So this is why you have an eclipse of the moon covering the sun. Now, of course, there's a everything's on an elliptical orbit, so the sun appears to grow and shrink in size, and also the moon's on an elliptical orbit, and it appears to grow and shrink. So your different eclipses have a different amount of totality. So the actual shadow in terms of size changes as it hits the Earth. So if you're in a position that it's the we're in our closest approach to the sun, therefore the sun will appear biggest, and the moon is furthest from us, you will not actually get a total eclipse, or the total eclipse will be very, very small. That's because the moon, angular position of the moon is rather small, and this angular change of angular size is known as supermoon if it comes to us very close. We get all variations on this. So this is just to give you the general picture of the size and distance of the moon and also of the sun. Now, what I now have is I want you to take you on a mental journey as to what's inside the sun, and then once we've got to what's inside the sun, we can actually start to talk about what's happening at the various layers, and various things happen at these different layers. So the center of the sun itself, most of the sun is made up of primordial hydrogen and primordial, I'm giving an Australian pronunciation, I very rarely get to say these words in common conversations out here as I'm sort of buying fruit, saying hello to people. But these initial hydrogen and helium. Now, we've been able to model what's happening in the Big Bang. So the Big Bang occurred, very hot, very small, dense point. So the universe was a point size. And the amazing thing is that we're actually inside that point. We're not outside the universe, we're inside that point, and we've seen the edges of that point at the moment. And we can actually see, I think, 40,000 years after the Big Bang, the actual fireball became translucent, and we can actually see. So we can see in the past there. But by clever detection work, we worked out what was happening when protons were formed and the first hydrogen formed from the quark soup to make the Big Bang. So we're following this explanation as to what's inside our sun. And it's useful to know. And the universe was so dense that the universe itself was a fast-acting sun. And so within minutes, it was the universe was beginning to burn up the hydrogen fuel. And it actually stopped exactly at half the hydrogen turned into helium. Half the hydrogen turning into helium Basically, if I have, to make it more fair and accurate, if I have seven protons, seven hydrogens, bear in mind that these were not atoms at this time. Things were so hot it didn't actually settle down to normal matter. It was a plasma. But say if I have seven atoms of hydrogen, and they're cooking very quickly, and the hydrogen is forming into helium. If four of those hydrogens form into a helium, I will have one hydrogen, two hydrogens, three hydrogens, and four, five, six, seven of those hydrogens, the last ones will form into a helium. So helium is two protons and two neutrons form together in a nucleus. This forms together. But that means gives us the final ratio of matter in the universe. The matter in the universe is roughly 1/4 helium and 3/4 hydrogen, and that's what it is in the outer surface of the sun and say in Jupiter, for instance. That's the actual mixture. It's made out of that primordial galactic gas has collapsed into it. That's very interesting because we can now do exact models of this fusion process, the first creation fusion. There's actually not a term for it, but I'm giving it a term for now, the creation fusion. And we can actually see the actual abundance and actually rewind the computer simulation. So the fusion part of creation after the Big Bang, if you want to call it that, took around 12 minutes. I've seen 18 minutes. I really was more fascinated in the actual detective work and then remembering the actual times, but roughly 1/4 hour, give or take a few minutes, the hydrogen was formed into helium, and that's gone to make our sun. Now, this is where I get to talk about the core again. So I've talked about the core, radiation zone, convection zone, photosphere, chromosphere. I'm about to get into the more exciting point beyond that, which I want to talk about this episode. But in the core, the middle 20% of the sun, or if the sun is 100 times the size of Earth, so it's 20 Earth widths across, so that's a fair amount of high dense material. The pressures are such that the primordial helium and hydrogen are compressed together, and the hydrogen is being turned into helium. And I think this produces around 2 watts. That's 2 joules per second per ton. Now, a ton of that material, that pressure, I think, I haven't done the, I did the calculations once. It's roughly about a litre. It's like a ton of iron is a fair whack, but if you compress it as much as it is, it's not a large volume, but it's 2 watts per liter, and it's got the same sort of energy output as a hot compost heap. In terms of volume per volume, it's got the same energy output of a compost heap, and I suppose in my cardiac recovery, I've walked past in the mountains here with the cold air and seen these warm steam ghosts living, rising from various compost heaps around the mountains as you walk around the place. But so if you put your hand in a compost, it's slightly warm. Like you are producing much more energy yourself than composting. You're producing much more energy inside of you. So basically, I suppose a decomposing body would produce the same sort of heat just by decomposing that heat. So this is producing a lot of heat. And so you expect more helium to be produced in the center of the sun. And indeed, I think the helium density is quite, increasing quite a lot in the centre of the sun. I can't really, off the top of my head, remember the number I've read it once. And so this hydrogen is slowly burning and turning into helium, increasing the helium density. The helium is a heavier unit, and so it's, the sun is producing exhaust, but the exhaust is infilling. It's like this internal combustion engine where the actual waste fuel is going on the inside. And from this, we can actually work out the lifetime of our sun. So our sun's core, which is this very inner center of the sun, is slowly going from hydrogen rich to hydrogen poor as it burns through. And the activity of the sun increases. It's slowly getting hotter over time. So essentially, I think the sun's got another 5 billion years. And again, this is off the top of my head. Just, I haven't planned any of this. I'm just data dumping off the top of my head. I think about a billion and a half years, the sun will increase in temperature so much that the water vapor will be scorched off Earth. We won't be able to have any water on Earth. So in essence, the Goldilocks zone for our solar system will move out, and Earth will slip underneath the Goldilocks zone. Now, a lot of this heating is due to the fusion process beginning to pick up pace. And there's a few reasons behind it. One reason is that there's a build-up of pressure which allows carbon contamination to drive fusion at a fast rate. There's a carbon-nitrogen-oxygen cycle where hydrogen sticks to carbon, forms nitrogen, sticks to nitrogen, forms oxygen, breaks apart with a helium, giving you carbon gain. So this process is a very, I think it's, at the moment there's only, well, less than 1% of this secondary process going on. But as this secondary process happens in the core, it will pick up heat. And I think there's been a noticeable increase in heat of the sun, even in the time of, since the dinosaurs, or the early life. So we know that the life, that the sun is increasing, picking up in temperature. So we're fortunate to have processes happening which sort of stabilize the temperature, but we're slowly going to be cooked alive. Also, going back to the time at the very earliest forms of life. So I notice I've said that the interesting life really has started at 500 million years ago, but much earlier we have other life on Earth. And this is just to give you a little picture of what's going on. And so we've been able to measure the effective temperature of the temperature of Earth and the amount of light falling on Earth. We've also been able to measure the number of days in the year. And so back in the very early times where we had these little basically stromatolites, I can't really pronounce it. Funny, I've read it, I've never had to actually say it to anybody else, so you'll have to look it up. We can see those build up and have daily lines in it, so we can actually count the number of days in a year by looking at these things. And very early on, there was 400 days in a year, so the Earth was spinning faster, the Moon was much closer, and so as the Earth spins anti-clockwise, the Moon slowly gets pushed out due to tidal forces. The tidal forces were much greater. So every tide you see, it's great. You get the energy of the tide. The actual moon is moving further out. Just to get back onto to get back here, we've got the core. The core's in the center of the sun. It's getting more heavy with helium as we go along here. One of the things I want to do is, now that we've panned out, I'm sort of wandering about the place. This is a problem of of podcasting off the top of your head. It's not only the Earth is orbiting anti-clockwise, if you look at it, and rotating anti-clockwise, meaning that it has to rotate a little bit more because it's moved around in space by a degree, so it's got to rotate another degree. The other thing which is moving anti-clockwise, you'd guess it would be rather disturbing if it wasn't, is that the Sun is moving anti-clockwise. So what that means is that the Sun takes roughly, a month to rotate completely in space. And I think the equator's doing around 35 days and the poles are doing 23. I'm really just taking that off memory. So the equator's moving fast, but on average it takes around 28 days for the Sun to do a full rotation. Oh, 32. The bottom line is that in that month we are moving 28 degrees around anti-clockwise. So it's rotating, but we're actually rotating with it. So the Sun is rotating faster, but we see it rotating more slowly. So I think it's rotating once, perhaps you'll have to look this up, every 23 days, but we, because we're moving through space or running alongside its rotation, if you like, we see it rotate once every 28 days, and we can see the differential rotation of the Sun. So features we see on the Sun, the sunspots in the photosphere, we can see the central sunspots in the belly start to twist and move around, shear and move around as it moves at different speeds. But the important thing is that the core is part of the radiative zone. And the radiative zone is the central, 90% of the Sun, 80% of the Sun. It's sort of really no stellar mechanics in general, rather than actually having studied the Sun precisely. So the radiative zone, as I said last episode, should, to be faithful to physics, be called the conduction zone. So heat actually conducts, so it's similar to if you hold, a barbecue, metal barbecue implement in your barbie, it will heat up eventually. The heat will travel slowly from the flame up to your hand. If you've got an expensive copper or silver one, it'll happen really quickly. If you've got a cheaper stainless steel one, it will travel less quickly. I could easily just go into the physics of why things conduct at different rates. So the conduction of the Sun from the core to get through the radiative zone is a million years of slowly walking of that temperature. So if I put 10 joules, for instance, or light a match in the center of the Sun, that heat will slowly work its way out over that time. And for the sort of the purposes of working out what's going on, it's best to call that radiative zone the non-convection zone. So this central zone, the radiative zone, is effectively solid. And I've asked you last time to imagine what a solid is, but a solid is like the Earth. The Earth is solid, and when the Earth rotates, it shears against the atmosphere and creating a wind, and this is true for the radiative zone. So there's no convection in the radiative zone, is because the pressure builds up so intensely that there's an equation for convection, and convection just simply does not take off in the radiative zone. So when something heats up, it doesn't expand sufficiently to become buoyant. So the increase in temperature isn't matched by the increase of compression by the pressure going in as you go in. And so if you heat something up, the heat just stays there and moves up. Now, I'll just at this point say that you can do a rather neat experiment to sort of display this in your classroom. You can get some salt in a test tube, a fair amount of salt, a little bit of water, dissolve that at the bottom of your test tube, and then carefully fill in fresh water on top of it. So you have a density gradient from the underneath, from the base of your test tube upwards. And if you put a match underneath your test tube and the student holds the other end, you'll feel the water at the very bottom of the test tube suddenly erupt, even if the heat of the match is sufficient for it to erupt. And you'll feel it vibrate as it turns to gas but can't convect upwards. So this process, the lack of convection, means that the heat builds up and slowly moves out. So you can actually make a test tube version of this inner radiative zone. Now, the radiative zone is where, in the center of it, is the core, which is all the heat is produced. When the radiative zone finishes, you have the tachosphere, which is the shear position, and it then goes into the convective zone. The convective zone is where all the magnetic field is. So the shear, the plasma energy of being ripped by this convection zone, as there's a differential speed between the radiative zone. So the radiative zone in the equator is going faster than the core, and in the poles it's going more slowly than the core. And all the way, if you go down into the sun, you've got this fantastic solid layer which is generating magnetic fields, which means that the convection is a current which actually then drives the wind. So the heat of the sun is actually is being tapped off and driving the magnetic fields, and the magnetic fields are heating up the sun. So the heat of the sun is actually escaping via the magnetic field of vibrations further up into the atmosphere. And that's what we've got to get to. And this is the most fascinating aspect. So this zone, the tachosphere in the center of the sun, this is all plasma physics. I must admit, look, I think I understood the equations at the time. I just took it over, and I thought, oh, look, I'm not going to be discussing it with anybody. Let's enjoy what's going on. So we're moving up to this next layer again, which is the radiative zone. And the radiative zone, you have obviously hot gas moving up in circles, a bit like a boiling water. But the gas moving has... this plasma moving has great electric charges. The electric charges moving creates a localized magnetic field. Magnetic field then creates something called a zeta pinch, which collapses the plasma into different densities, into little columns. It is called zeta pinch. This creates a writhing soup of magnetic field lines. Now, I suppose conceptually I have this real problem knowing the history of magnetic field lines, but we won't get into that. If the conceptualization of magnetic field lines and the actual visualization of phenomena, you really couldn't go past looking at the sun. These people, say breaking magnetic field lines, it's actually impossible. It's a concept. Magnetic field lines is a concept, but a plasma stream which effectively concentrates magnetic field lines, the plasma stream, it can knot and break, and you can get this plasma effect. I won't go into it. It's just a bit more pedantic about what the magnetic field lines are. So let's start again. We've got the core. The core is in the radiative zone, or the non-convective zone. It starts off the convective zone. This generates a huge magnetic field, and the convective zone eventually reaches up to something called the photosphere. The photosphere is the sun that you and I can see. It's the sun where it is producing most of the light. It produces light very much as an incandescent light bulb or in your Barbie, for instance. If you've got a coal Barbie, you put coal beads and that brightness is from there. It's the same point in a hurricane lamp. The hurricane lamp produces little particles of carbon, and these particles of carbon emit all this light. So the photosphere is really the outer layer of the radiation zone. And now the reason it actually transitions from the radiation zone into the photosphere, so the photosphere is, I think, 600 kilometres thickness. That's the optical depth point. So the photosphere is defined by points in which light will escape the sun. That's a black body light will escape the sun. So in the photosphere, this sits on top of the radiation zone. And so you'll see this is sort of not in the radiation zone, in the convection zone, you'll get large variations in temperature as the convection is going in cells. But this is almost like a mask of uniform gas, where this convection is not stopping, it's heating this gas. It's sort of trapped in the region up there. And in that region, you have areas I suppose don't cut as deeply. The magnetic field pops through this, so the magnetic field is largely self-contained, but you can have sunspots in which the convective layer is not transmitting to the photo layer as much, photosphere as much, and it cools down, but you get these large magnetic fields, which is sort of locks the gas and stops it churning away. So the sunspot is colder, it's still very bright, but it's not glowing as bright as the rest of the sun, but the magnetic fields is locking it down, stopping the heat transport through it. And so this is, I suppose, obviously why a sunspot is dark. I suppose getting back on these magnetic fields, they're unstable magnetic fields. So the sun really, if you've got a normal magnet, it will stay there as a normal magnet. But every 11 years, the sun, the poles flip. It's sort of like this crazy mad magnet. And so it'll flip, stabilize for a nice uniform point in time, and then become unstable, and the sun will have multiple poles, the magnetic field will go everywhere, it will scramble and reorient, so the poles of the sun are going north-south every 11 years, quite reliably back into history. We've been able to measure the sunspot or sun activity. Now, the interesting thing here is that the sun activity is what's happening is this is the ability of the photosphere to transmit heat out of the sun. It's not to do with the core. The core is not changing in heat. It's the photosphere, the interaction with the photosphere. And there's many ways to look at it, about how much the solar wind will vary, the magnetic fields will vary, the actual energy between the light out of the sun. So the energy poured into light changes. So it pours energy into different buckets of energy output of the sun. Some of it's light, some of it's magnetic field energy, and we'll go into that, and some of it's structural energy or kinetic energy of the surface of the sun. So we've got the photosphere. Now, the important thing about the photosphere is that the photosphere could be any depth, if you like. So if you've got a bigger photosphere, the more it goes, the larger it is, and the redder the light of the sun comes out. So if I have a very large photosphere, very deep photosphere, it's got the same amount of energy over a greater surface, so the sun will appear redder. And so this is the, we'll get into it. This is something to really marvel at, the sun that you're looking at. So above the photosphere is the chromosphere. So the photosphere, if you've got a match, the photosphere is the yellow flame. The chromosphere is the bluish flame. So you can see the blue flame. This is basically not black body radiation, but this is gas, hot gas radiation. So this is optically thin, much like a neon sign is an optically thin, thin gas, something which is optically thin. Say if you're going to burn some alcohol or some acetone, it's a very hot flame, but it's you can't see the flame. And so this is basically the sun is filled with the photosphere is a glowing layer, and above this is the chromosphere, which is this very thin gas. I think it stretches around 2,000 kilometers. And this is where the drama happens. So it's a atomic emission line. So it's basically, if you've got your atom, the atom is left by itself. It's thin enough, the atom is left by itself. It gets under a collision with an electron or something like that. And so the atom promotes this electron to a high orbital level and then drops down, emitting light. And so you get basically the atomic emission. It's an atomic emission lamp. So you've got your hot lamp, which is the photosphere, and above it, surrounded, is the atomic emission lines. Now, if you observe the line through a narrow band filter, which throws away all light except for the narrow band, you'll suddenly see this beautiful thing called the chromosphere. So chrome is colour, or colour from the spectrum. This is where you get the emission lines coming out of the sun. So if you have these filters and you can buy it for your telescope, it's quite worthwhile doing. You can get these hydrogen red lines. So if you look at the spectrum, pull up on the internet, you'll get the red the principal, I think it's 3-2, it's a Balmer series, I'm not quite sure. Very strong visible line. So if you've got a hydrogen, so basically if you've got a hydrogen lamp, iron lamp, I'm going to have to stop here. So we're going up to the chromosphere. Unfortunately, I'm out here giving it, and my family's coming back at night, so I'll have to stop. And we're really close, and there I'll do the transition zone, chromosphere and transition zone next. Okay, we'll see you, and I'll put this out. So there's going to be a part 3 where I'll do the next thing. It's worthwhile listening to it. Bye.